This is a recording from the 1st of February 2020 of an online webinar held at 4 p.m. hosted by the Australian Chinese Medical Association of Victoria to update doctors serving the Chinese community on the Victorian response to novel coronavirus. Please note that all information is current as of the 1st of February 2020 and may have been superseded by subsequent events. All information is for clinical purposes and not for media release.
Thank you to everyone who has joined. My name is Jason Chuen. I'm the recent past president of the Chinese Medical Association of Victoria. We have online with us some of our other executive members of the Chinese Medical Association, including current president Rebecca Nguyen and Shira Leone, Dixon Woon, Nora Lee, and previous president Chris Leung. So the Chinese Medical Association has taken some effort to arrange this webinar in order to help all of you be up to date with current guidelines and the current state of play in terms of novel coronavirus in Victoria. I know you have lots of questions and I don't want to delay having those answered. Our expert team, our infectious diseases physicians online at the moment are Jason Kwong, Lin Lee Lim. So Jason Kwong is an ID physician at the Austin. Lin Lee is based at Box Hill Hospital, and Alan Cheng is an infectious disease physician based at Alfred and professor through Monash University. We also have online from the Department of Health and Human Services, Annalise Van Diemen, who is running the communicable diseases portfolio, and Brett Sutton is online somewhere, the Chief Health Officer, and hopefully he will be in full swing shortly. We have also Julian Raitt, who is the president of AMA Victoria, and thank you to Julian for helping us pull this together. I'm going to hand over at this stage to Alan Cheng, but just before I do that, I would ask that any members of the media who have joined and any journalists that this is not a press briefing. I would ask you to disconnect now, and any information that is given in this meeting, none of the speakers have given permission for that to be disseminated. This is a clinician-only meeting, and I would ask that any discussion be targeted towards clinical questions rather than a commentary of the world in general. So, Alan, I've allocated you about 15 to 20 minutes to speak, and then we will take questions. There is a Q&A function. If you look around your windows, you will be able to type some questions, and they will either be answered by the speaker or they may be answered as a text message, either directly or shared amongst the audience. So, Alan, I will hand over to you at this stage.
Okay. Thanks, Jason, and thanks for the opportunity to speak to this group. It's clearly a very important group, and you're seeing a lot of the patients. So we have some ID physicians. We've got a representative in public health, including the Chief Health Officer and the Deputy Chief Health Officer. Jason, I'll just rely on you to let me know if there's any problems with the audio or anything like that. So what we're going to talk about is just about coronaviruses and what's happened. Some of the things that you probably hear a lot about in the media and on Twitter and so on, about R0 and the case fatality rate. I'm just going to give you a bit of an insight into what's happening at the Victorian and Australian level in terms of public health authorities, because that's often not very visible to anyone. And then a clinical approach. What do I do if I see a patient with suspected coronavirus? How do I protect myself? And then what do I tell patients who might want to go overseas? So coronaviruses actually are not uncommon. So they are four strains of them cause the common cold. And there's those funny ones with letters. But there have obviously been three very important coronaviruses over the last 20 years, the SARS coronavirus and the MERS coronavirus, and then this new one, which doesn't have a formal name yet. The difference between the common cold ones and the SARS and MERS and this new coronavirus is that these new ones are what's called zoonotic. So they've crossed over from probably from animals into humans in some way. And that's what's why they're causing more disease. What's happened here is that in late December, there was this cluster of pneumonia that was of unknown origin. And actually very quickly, it was linked to a seafood wholesale market in Hubei province. And then really only a week later, this novel coronavirus was isolated, and then the whole genome sequence, the genetic sequence of this was reported. And then obviously we're now 1 month since the beginning of this cluster, and we now have lots of cases and lots of transmissions going on. And obviously this has come at a very difficult time with the mass movement of people within China and with travel across borders for Chinese New Year. So this is a rapidly evolving situation. These numbers are pretty much out of date as soon as they're written, but I wrote this presentation last night when there was 9,658 confirmed cases. This is probably an under-ascertainment of the number of cases because not because of any deliberate under-reporting, but just because it's probably not possible to find and do the testing on all the people that have infection. It's probably plausible that there are estimates of probably 100,000 people that have this infection, although the extent of it and how many of those cases might be fairly mild are not really certain at this stage. Again, the numbers of cases outside China are increasing as well, but they're really a very small fraction of what's happening within China. But there's only probably, I think, up to 20 countries as of now have been reported. In Australia, the first case was at Monash Medical Centre in Victoria on the 24th of January. There are now 4 cases in Victoria and 9 cases around Australia. So another 4 in Sydney and then 1 in the Gold Coast. And again, these numbers, I think, are changing fairly quickly as well. Within China, most of the cases seem to be reported from Hubei province. Although many other provinces have reported significant numbers, but none of them to the same magnitude. So the reporting in Guangzhou province, for example, is several hundred rather than the sort of the many thousands that are reported in Hubei. And obviously there have been very draconian measures taken by the Chinese authorities to try and reduce transmission of this. We do get an idea of what's going on inside China from who is presenting outside of China, where we have quite good, quite a good idea of where they've been. So almost all the cases, at least reported to WHO, have had a history of travel to Wuhan or Hubei province. There are a couple of transmissions that have occurred outside of China, so more recently a cluster reported in Germany, and then there's a few where the information is not available. So it does appear at this stage that things are concentrated on Hubei province. In terms of the clinical findings, the incubation period, so the time between exposure and when people start to show symptoms is between 4 and 10 days, an average of about 7 days, but the upper limit is thought to be about 14 days. It presents, the first series suggests that fever was very common, although some of the more recent cases suggest that you can present without fever. There seems to be more presentations with lower respiratory tract symptoms, so cough and shortness of breath, rather than the upper respiratory tract symptoms of sore throat and runny nose. Like with influenza and other viral diseases, you can get some diarrhea and things like that. The chest x-ray findings, this is from one of the New England reports of a severe case, and you can see there's sort of infiltrates all through the lung, and it's almost like an ARDS or a new viral pneumonitis-like picture. With the severe cases, there's obviously impairment of gas exchange and dyspnea, there's multi-organ failure that's described. But all the cases in Australia have been relatively mild. Some of them have had chest x-ray findings, but none of them are in intensive care. In terms of the transmission, this is really an area of uncertainty at the moment, and it's evolving. It's thought that, what we know from SARS and MERS is that most spread is via contact and via droplets. Although particularly in SARS, there was this concept of aerosol generating procedures, particularly intubation and bronchoscopy and so on, where aerosols could be generated and where additional protection might be required. all the evidence at this stage suggests human-to-human contact, mainly in sometimes in hospital settings and mainly in the community in Hubei province. But this is likely to change and increase as time goes on. An important question is around whether this virus might be transmissible before the onset of symptoms. And this is, I think, a couple of days ago, the New England published the details of some German cases. The diagram's a little bit complicated to understand, but basically the index patient was a person that had been visiting Germany on a business trip and met with patient one and patient two. And then on her return on the flight back to China, she presented with symptoms and then got a test, and then she was known to be positive. So it appears in this case that she had transmitted her infection to patient one and patient two before she had shown symptoms. Similarly, patient three and patient four had only had contact with patient one. She had, those two patients hadn't had contact with the index patient. And they seem to have acquired infection while before patient one got symptoms. Having said that, this is the only documented case. There are reports of in China that of possible cases where this might have happened, but obviously in that setting, it's harder to document where the infection might have come from. So at this stage, it is thought that pre-symptomatic transmission is possible, but not very common. You might hear a lot about this R0, basic reproductive number, and this is an epidemiological concept about how many people and a person infects. So on average, it's thought that one infection causes 2 to 4 infections in the community on average. That doesn't mean there may be super spreaders that infect a lot of people, and then some people don't infect many people at all, but this is sort of the average. Just to put this in context, as you may know, measles is very, very infectious. If you're even in the vague vicinity of someone with measles and you're not immune, then you're much more likely to get it. And some of the other infections there you can see. This seems to be very similar to SARS, in terms of its transmissibility. The other question that's obviously very important is what the case fatality ratio is, and that is the number of the proportion of people who get infected that go on to die. It's almost impossible to work out what this would be at this stage of the infection, this stage of the outbreak, because some of the people that will go on to die haven't died yet, so we don't know what that figure looks like in the numerator. And we also don't know about the extent of people that get mild infection. So if there's a lot of people with mild infection, then this case fatality rate might be smaller than we think. In terms of what's happening in around Australia, there is an established system of coordination of public health actions. And this is, there are two main committees here, the what's called AHPPC, the Australian Health Protection Principal Committee, which is chaired by the Chief Medical Officer of Australia, Brendan Murphy, and all the state and territory chief health officers, including Brett Sutton, who's online. And then the other committee is the Communicable Diseases Network of Australia, which is comprises all heads of communicable diseases at each jurisdiction, as well as some experts. And that includes Annelies van Diemen, who's the Victorian representative there. This has triggered a national incident response. So the National Incident Response Room had already been activated for the bushfires and for a few other things that have been happening, but obviously this is very important. And there's also been a national guideline that's been written and is available online. In terms of the international health regulations, these have been triggered, and this is what's regarded as a public health emergency of international concern, which is designated by the World Health Organization. That allows countries to take extra actions and for the World Health Organization to monitor and ask questions of countries with about their preparedness and their responses. The recommendation from AHPPC at this stage is Travellers that return from Hubei province, those that have had close contact and those people that have had been in hospitals in China are required to isolate themselves after the last exposure. Obviously, this has been very difficult for some people to comply with, and it obviously has a lot of implications for settings like hotels and universities and so on. So there's been guidance provided for that. This at this stage, there may be changes to this, and it's worth keeping an eye out for official communications about this requirement. In terms of the Victorian response, there is an incident management team within Victoria. The Department of Health and Human Services authorise all the testing of suspected cases, and they will follow up all the cases and all the contacts. We're lucky in Victoria that we have Vidral, the Victorian Infectious Diseases Reference Lab, which is a very expert lab that is able to do all the testing and was one of the first labs in the world, in fact, to have the test available. And they've been developing this and been able to grow the virus to allow further work to be done. There's really very extensive information on the DHHS website. There's information for the public and for health professionals, and there's a lot of resources, including signage and including Chinese language signs. On the DHHS website, there is a state guideline which says what to do. And what I'm going to do is to save you a bit of reading say what might be useful for you to know. So just to remind you that there are different types of precautions. There's what's called contact precautions. We do this for like MRSA and CPE and those sorts of things. There's airborne precautions for measles and TB with the P2 mask. And then there's droplet precautions, which is for what we would normally do for influenza. So droplet precautions are a surgical mask, using eye protection, so some goggles or glasses, gloves, gown, and obviously hand hygiene. And this is sufficient for the coronavirus for routine patient care. So by routine patient care, I mean talking to the patient, examining them. And you should put the mask on the patient so if they cough or sneeze, that will catch anything that comes out. Airborne precautions are a higher standard of protection, and this is the P2 mask or the ductile mask that you see there. Again, the same as well. In hospitals, we're probably a little bit more familiar with doing this because of the number of people with measles and TB we see. So if you're particularly with your junior college colleagues, it may be worth coaching them, just standing by while they're putting it on and taking it off just to make sure they're doing it correctly. So for coronavirus, this is required for what's called aerosol generating procedures. And in general practice, the most common situation for this would be taking a nasopharyngeal swab. Should try and avoid aerosol generating procedures and particularly nebulizers. So using spacers instead of nebulizers is recommended. So how can you prepare for this? So the first thing is really just to have some systems that might identify patients that might call up and say, you know, I'm worried about this. I need to be seen, or I've just come back from China. I need to be seen. So talking to your reception staff or your practice nurses and practice manager. It is worth having some screening questions for the staff so that they can just read from a script and say, you know, have you been in China in the last 14 days? Are you unwell now? If you have a practice website, it might be worth just putting a note on that. And then also having signage from in English and in Chinese. There are some resources on the Department of Health website. So it's also important that to keep up to date with what the current advice is, because this is changing fairly frequently. You can understand that with the change in the number of cases in China, you know, what area is being regarded as an area of risk is changing, you know, from day to day. These committees are meeting every day, and you know, there will be changes to the advice. So what do you need? You need somewhere to put the patient, some space. So you identify a room or a place that you're going to put a patient if they say, I've been to Hubei and I'm unwell. You need personal protective equipment, so some masks, gowns and gloves, and we can talk about that in a moment. You need some alcohol hand gel, which you should have ready, swabs, which you can get from the pathology, your pathology provider, disinfectant wipes. There is a DHHS quick guide for GPs that might be helpful. So I understand, and Annalise can talk about this later, there are surgical masks and P2 masks that are being distributed to public health networks. But just bearing in mind that, you know, this is relatively early in the outbreak. There isn't an unlimited supply of these masks, and actually there probably wouldn't be expected to be too many patients, so you don't need to wear them for every single patient interaction, only the ones where this might be suspected. So who might you suspect with novel coronavirus? So the clinical features are acute respiratory symptoms. Initially it was said that they had to have fever, now it's just any acute respiratory infection. This obviously doesn't include heart failure and so on. This is people with, you know, upper respiratory tract or lower respiratory tract infections. And then epidemiological risk factors. So they've been in Hubei in the last 14 days. They've been in contact with a hospital in China in the last 14 days, or they've had contact with a known case. So what do you do then? Well, give the patient a mask and put them in a single room and then close the door. So anyone who goes into that room needs some sort of personal protective equipment. For routine care, that's a surgical mask and eye protection and glove and gown and so on. Have a chat to the patient and just make sure that they, take the detailed history of where they've been, their symptoms, exactly when did they leave Hubei or China. And then if it does seem to match those criteria, so it's within the last 14 days and there are acute respiratory symptoms, then that's the number to call. And that's a 24-hour hotline for the Department of Health. So if after discussing with the Department of Health that they say you can go ahead and take a swab, then you should put on a P2 mask and the rest of the personal protective equipment, do your hand hygiene. The ideal swab is whatever's available from your pathology provider, but is ideally a flocked swab. And you hold it, you've probably taken these before for flu, but it's flat to the base of the nose. And if you do it correctly, the patient's eyes should water. I've had this enough times that it's not the most pleasant experience. So you send it via your usual pathology provider. You should call ahead to let them know so that they know what to expect. And then either the patient goes home or to hospital if they're unwell, obviously. Then you can clean the room with disinfectant wipes or whatever you clean it with normally. The room needs to rest for 30 minutes. So this is the same basically as if your patient had measles.
Alan, sorry to interrupt. Just very briefly, one more thing to pop on your pathology slip is that you had called DHHS. So something along the lines of DHHS approved, because some of the primary paths are holding swabs before they send them on if they don't know that they've been approved by us.
Great. Okay, thanks, Alan.
So just note that you've called us on your paths.
In terms of what you should take, two nasopharyngeal swabs, sputum if the patient is producing sputum, and then if you're going to send them to hospital, please call the hospital to let them know so that they know what to expect and they can prepare for the patient. The last thing is really pre-travel advice, so if this may become academic as time goes on and if no one is travelling to China. There's a Smart Traveller website for official warnings. I think it's important. There's travel insurance is a very complicated beast. If the patient's thinking of cancelling, let them know that they probably should call before they cancel, because there's a huge list of exclusions. If people are to go to anywhere in the region where there might be cases, personal hygiene, particularly hand hygiene, is very important. And even though the flu vaccine obviously doesn't protect against coronavirus, the last thing you want trying to come out of a country that is a very alert for influenza-like illnesses, you don't really don't want the flu. So it's probably worthwhile getting the flu vaccine. So what's probably going to happen next with all of this? So it is possible that, although increasingly less likely, that that China will control this infection. It is possible that there'll be established transmission in China, or perhaps other countries, particularly in our region, that may have not as strong health services as China or Australia. I think it's less likely that there will be established transmission in Australia, although we are obviously at a high level of alert for this. There is there are preparedness plans for what would happen if the infection came to Australia, and that's in this document, the Australian Health Management Plan for thinking of pandemic influenza. And this has a whole list of things that could be done in terms of border controls and so on. The public health authorities can select from these menu of options to work out what is the best thing to do in any particular situation. There was a paper published overnight that looked at what was likely to happen. They thought that it's likely that there has been spread of this infection to major cities. And curiously, the more effective control is, the longer an outbreak you have. So if there was no control, then there would be a very sharp peak in infections over the next couple of weeks or months. But if there's very effective controls, this may go on for quite some time. I think the just last thing I wanted to say was that there is quite a lot of misinformation out on social media, and I think it's as health professionals, for all of us, it's really important that we keep across what is credible and plausible. Really urge you to look at official sources of information, the Australian and Victorian Departments of Health, the World Health Organization, the US CDC and the European CDC and the China CDC. All have keeping numbers up to date and have quite a lot of information on their websites. So finally, just to say that there is a public coronavirus hotline. There's a 1-800 number there. And then there's a separate number for medical public health emergencies. And that's the notification number that you've probably called in the past. And there's, if you go through the menu, then you can speak to a public health officer about testing or any queries you might have. So I might thank some people for helping me put together this presentation. So I might throw over to Annelies van Diemen just to answer some of the questions that that you've got.
Thanks, Alan. Would people like to? We've been answering some of the Q&As as they've been coming up, and a few things that I've just noted down during Alan's discussion was that we're trying very hard with our comms team to get a 24/7. Translation service going. We know that the translations to simple and other Chinese languages have been taking longer than the English updates. So we're trying very hard to make sure that those translations can happen as quickly as possible as things change on a day-to-day basis. I suppose the second question for health practitioners is we haven't translated the big guide for healthcare health practitioners at this point in time, and would that be something that is useful for people? So if that's the case, we can work on getting that done as quickly as possible. In terms of what's outstanding on the question and answer at the moment, Lisa has asked, we've heard people from any part of China need 14-day quarantine in the US. I will confess I'm on leave as of today and spent the morning packing up to go on holidays this morning's teleconference, but Alan might be able to expand on that. So, I've not read all my emails yet today.
Yep. So so overnight, the US announced a travel ban for foreign nationals to going to the United States. For American citizens that have been in China, they're going to be quarantined for 14 days. That's a similar policy to Singapore as well. So they're the two countries that have done that at this stage.
There were some questions that were submitted prior to the meeting. I don't know if you have had a chance to have a look at those, Alan.
Yeah.
But we might address some of them while we're sorting out which ones to answer in the live Q&A.
Yep. Okay. So the first question is about the taking a sampling in a clinic located in a high-rise building with no windows and only aircon. So ideally, a patient with suspected coronavirus should just go straight to a single room until they're assessed, and then for the routine assessment, so when you go and talk to the patient to work out where they've been, put on a surgical mask with on the patient, a surgical mask and the other personal protective equipment for the doctor. Then if the patient fits the case definition, call DHHS. And then to do the swab, you need the additional protection of a P2 mask with PPE, clean the room with wipes, and then rest the room for 30 minutes. The 30 minutes is for a room with just routine air conditioning. So in hospitals increased air ventilation, that can be lower. But for 30 minutes is the safe period of time. And that's what you would do for measles as well.
And after disposing of the personal protective equipment, Alan, there's a question of whether the clinician needs to wash down or shower or decontaminate before seeing the next patient.
No, just hand hygiene, routine hand hygiene, and then obviously taking off the personal protective equipment. In terms of the assessment of asymptomatic patients, so hopefully asymptomatic patients won't come to actually see you, and if they call ahead, then there's an opportunity to reassure them that they don't need to be tested. If they do come in and they're asymptomatic, then put the surgical mask on the patient and obviously wear the surgical mask yourself, and then you obviously have to establish that they do actually have no symptoms. If they don't have symptoms, then no swab is required, and then just the routine disinfection of the room with wipes. There's a question about which is the best ED to send patients to. So the answer is probably the one that's closest to you. But having said that, GPs really have a very important role in reassuring people who are what we call the worried well. So people that are not really at risk, they're not unwell or haven't been in China. I think Jason Kwong said that he's had someone that went to a Chinese website and was worried he got a virus. But if you do send someone to ED, then call ahead to let them know that they're coming.
On that subject, Alan, and Annalise might want to jump in here. A lot of GPs feel that they're under-equipped to handle these patients, especially the swabs. Now, I know that equipment is being delivered, but there's feedback that GPs are feeling like they are under pressure to take these patients when they aren't equipped to do so, in that the hotline is directing patients to them. And there is a question about whether or not the department would consider setting up a centralised facility to see and assess these patients.
Annalise, you wanted to take that on?
Look, it's certainly something that has been discussed as a possibility if and when the numbers of this start to increase. Now, I understand that the numbers of people presenting concerns are significantly higher than the numbers of cases that we are seeing. And obviously that's made more difficult by the fact that it is flu season in China. So there will be a lot of returned travellers who have picked up influenza and other respiratory illnesses by virtue of the fact that it is winter. So I couldn't say that, yes, that it is something that we are doing right now, but it is something that has been discussed and is an active consideration, and that in the meantime, we'll be doing our absolute best to support general practitioners to practice within the scope of their confidence and their competence and the setup that they have in their clinics, knowing that every clinic is obviously different. And there's lots of GPs who want to continue to see their own patients and to manage their own patients within their communities. But obviously I understand that there will be some who are not physically set up to do it or don't feel confident with the training that they've had in terms of the PPE. So we'll be looking to make sure there's ways that we can support that if it is, we've got the rooms and we've got the equipment, but we're not confident using it, then we will be looking next week to try and support people in that. But obviously we're not going to force people to see patients if they don't feel comfortable doing so. I suppose the balance at the moment is managing people within their own communities, and B, trying to manage an overall system without it falling over, and trying to make sure that people don't get unnecessarily exposed to further risk in big EDs who've got potentially lots of other infectious patients in there, if that makes sense. So it's a fine balancing act, but obviously we're not going to force people to do things that they're not comfortable with, and we will continue to look at all available options as this disease progresses. But at the moment, we have only had the four cases, and we are testing a lot more. We're testing a lot more than the people who meet the case definition, and everything is coming up negative at the moment. But obviously, that advice is changing on a day-to-day basis.
Thanks for that, Annalise. There's have been some questions about the use of P2 versus normal surgical masks. Are you recommending that people use P2 masks routinely, or that there are specified circumstances where the P2 mask should be pulled out?
So that second one. So it's thought, and the WHO and European authorities recommend that just for routine patient care, that's just talking to the patient, you know, just going into the room, you know, examining them and so on, that surgical masks on the patient and the doctor are fine. But if you're going to do something that generates an aerosol, so a ventilator, intubate them, or doesn't happen in general practice, but taking a throat swab, asking them to cough and so on, then that requires the higher level of protection, which is the P2 mask. But a surgical mask is fine. This doesn't jump out of, it doesn't jump out and, you know, turn corners and so on. It still is not that infectious in terms of compared to things like TB and measles.
In the Q&A section, There's a question about the different symptoms other than cough. So one way asks whether or not there's transmission through what I assume is a cough or splash into the eye. And Lena also asks if a patient has diarrhea, or a potential patient has diarrhea and uses the toilet, what are the recommendations around managing that?
Yep. So it is thought that this can spread through to mucous membranes. So that's why if you take a swab, you should have eye protection and to stop them coughing in your eyes. And then the other one was about diarrhea. So diarrhea doesn't seem to be a huge feature of this illness. It is possible. If a patient does need to go to the toilet that is under suspicion, then you need to clean the toilet. So using disinfectant wipes and bleach if you have it. But just almost any disinfectant will inactivate this. So just some of the other questions from the Q&A. So there was a few questions about whether tests could be false negative. So any test can be false negative. If you don't take the swab well, then it's not going to have samples of the right place. And it is this that really reinforces the need to take a good swab. So the recommendation is that for patients in the community, that a single test is sufficient to exclude this, as long as you take the test well. But in hospitals, then where particularly people with pneumonia and so on, where the likelihood is a bit higher, then two tests are required. But a single test in the community is sufficient.
There's a question from Wei, who I assume is in Albury-Wodonga, about the discrepancy in recommendations between New South Wales and Victoria. I believe, for example, that New South Wales is recommending that all patients or potential patients present to hospital where there are clinics for them to be seen and assessed, whereas Victoria has different recommendations.
Different health services different jurisdictions have different systems for doing this. The system in Victoria is general practitioners are involved. The recommendation is different at the moment in New South Wales about using P2 masks. Every jurisdiction sort of came up with their own one independently, and a group was formed with Lynn Gilbert, who's one of the she was in charge of Ebola a few years ago, to come and sort of rationalise all of those. And the recommendation that her group has made is the one I've just told you. So the surgical mask. So for routine patient care, and P2 mask, and for taking a throat swab or other aerosol generating procedures. So New South Wales will change their recommendations to that, but those recommendations have only just been made on yesterday, actually. So they haven't changed yet.
Alan and Jason, can I go back to the previous question about the false negatives?
Yep.
Reading the question in the questions that were sent around, I understand that this was prompted by the fact that there is talk within the Chinese medical and other community that case 2 was told that he was cleared and therefore then went out for dinner to a restaurant because I was told it was cleared. I don't want there to be any concern about the test itself. That was categorically not a false negative. It was a mix-up with test results. So it did result in an awkward situation, obviously, and one that was regrettable, but it was not a false negative test. So I don't want there to be, I suppose, concern that the test is going to bring back false negatives. We'd probably prefer that not to be widely distributed, more so that the message that the tests, we're very confident in the test, and that they run two tests, not one, on every specimen. So they've got a real-time PCR that was developed in-house in Vidrill, and then there's a second real-time PCR that was developed in Germany, and both of those are being extensively cross-checked with positives and negatives. So we're pretty confident every test that's getting run from your specimens is getting run across two different PCRs that have both got seem to have very high sensitivity and specificity, and that we're doing double testing then for significantly unwell patients who are in hospital. So we're quite confident with the test at the moment. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I just reinforce that, you know, Vidrill, the lab that have done this test, are really one of the best labs in the world. They, you know, they're really at the forefront of developing all of this, and they were one of the first to actually get a test up and running. And they're the first to actually have grown this virus, so they're able to check that their tests are working. The next question is about deaths from novel coronavirus. So about who is getting this and who's dying from this. So we don't know huge amounts about this, but about half, what we do know is about half the patients in China that have had this seem to be over the age of 60 years. And many of them, but not all of them, have some chronic medical conditions. So some of those chronic medical conditions are sort of hypertension and things. So it's probably just a function of older people getting these infections. At this stage, seem to be relatively small numbers of children getting this. So the reason for why it affects older people and yet not younger people is not really clear. Probably relates to receptors and so on. But it does seem to be a condition of older people. There's a question about how to clean the room after exposure to a suspected or confirmed case. So I think I've been through that, but using disinfectant wipes and wiping down surfaces and then resting the room for 30 minutes. And this is the same as you would do if you had a case of measles. Will guidelines for testing extend beyond those that have been to Hubei, given how widespread it is in China? So this is under active consideration. So CDNA and AHBBC are meeting every day and sometimes twice daily. And the National Incident Room are monitoring the epidemiology continuously. So I really would urge you to keep an eye out for official communications, particularly over the next day or so.
Alan, I might just add in there, if people are not subscribed to the CHO Alert, I would strongly recommend that you do subscribe to the CHO Alert, because most or all major sort of updates and changes in this are being released via CHO Alert. New cases are often just that don't have a change in policy or guidance or recommendations for practitioners are being done via media release, but significant changes in the requirements or the recommendations and the testing guidelines are being updated via the CHO Alert, which comes into emails. So then we'll guide you to the relevant places in the website.
How do you do that, Annalise? Just go through the website.
I subscribe via dhhs.vic.gov.au. Yep.
Great. So the next question is about, do you think we've seen the peak? And if not, do we have government support for a statewide coordinated response? So I hope I've sort of outlined some of the activities that are happening at a statewide and national level. I think it is likely that cases will continue to increase in China, and there will be continue to be cases that are found elsewhere in the world as well. And I think it's really important that we all work together. So, you know, we've got public health, we've got hospital clinicians, primary care in the community, to really reduce the impact of this as much as possible. Were there any other ones from the Q&A list, Jason?
Yeah, actually, there's quite a few questions on the Q&A section. There's a few questions regarding the availability of masks. And Annalise, Alan, do you want to answer that? They're asking whether, you know, public health networks could provide access to masks.
Yeah, I can answer that one. So the primary health networks have two distributions going on at the moment. The Commonwealth have released, limited supply of surgical masks to go out via the primary health networks. So those masks are obviously appropriate for routine care, as Alan has discussed, and for the patient to wear throughout the duration of a consultation. The Victorian DHHS has released a supply of the P2 masks, and those are the ones to be used for taking respiratory samples. And they started being distributed yesterday, and should be continuing today. So each PHN is just obviously distributing a limited supply of those, but then that will increase as numbers of cases and the recommendations for testing broaden, which they seem to be doing on a semi-regular basis at the moment. But what we're urging, I suppose, is that people just use the P2 masks for those testing procedures so that we can preserve those. I'm getting lots of questions on the Q&A about shortages of surgical masks in general and suppliers not being able to supply, and I think that's going to be an active discussion for us in the department and with Commonwealth to really look at quite urgently next week. I don't have clear answers on how that might be addressed, because I'm really not quite certain about the distribution patterns and the distribution availability at the moment in the private market. But I think that's something that we will actively have to look at next week, because regardless of whether you're taking specimens or not, these patients need to have a mask put on when they walk in the clinic, obviously. So this will be an ongoing need. So I've popped it on as a priority action for our incident management team in the next week, or early in the next week, obviously. Sorry, there's one more question that I got halfway through typing an answer to from a respiratory physician in Glen Waverley who's been seeing patients with fever and cough and needing to test. Can you get in the N95 or P2 masks from the primary health network? I think as an outpatient setting, taking tests, yes, that would be appropriate. I'd advise you to contact your local primary health network, and then if you're having any difficulties, contact us at DHHS to help you if they're not deciding to send you any masks.
I might just step in here, everyone. Brett Sutton, Chief Health Officer. Just to say that I think we're in a rapidly evolving space. I think you can see that. So you will see change recommendations day to day, as Alan's pointed out, where meeting as CDNA and then AHPPC as all the Chief Health Officers on a daily basis. And there's new information that's coming in every day. It does look inconsistent when things change rapidly, but it's also the case that this wasn't an issue 2 months ago and that we're taking reasonably dramatic action now. So I think it's imperative to stay in touch on that, and to Annalisa's point about subscribing to the Chief Health Officer alerts, that's a key one. I've also got a Twitter handle, Victorian Cho, which is useful if I'm tweeting about those alerts. On the issue of have we reached the peak, no, we haven't. I think this is going to get worse before it gets better, absolutely. And I think we have to plan for the worst, and we are planning for the worst, and we need to hope for the best. But the pandemic planning and the national coordination mechanisms absolutely need to be activated and ready for whatever may come.
Well, it's getting on to 5 o'clock, and I appreciate that everyone's put aside an hour and more of their time. There are still questions in the Q&A to be answered, but what I might suggest is that we end the video conference now and give our panellists and our guests an opportunity to get back to what they need to do. If any of our panellists would like to stay and continue to answer questions either live or via text, then you are very welcome to. But I would say that there's no obligation for you to do so. There was one question, Alan, about whether or not your slides would be made available to people.
I'm happy to do that. There's nothing there that's sensitive, so.
Well, if you and I just work out how to make that available afterwards, then it will either be available on the ACMAB website or through the department if that's appropriate. So I'll give our speakers a chance to stay if they wish, but at this stage I thank you all for your hard work and also being here at short notice and pulling all of this together. Any remaining questions or things that have come up in the chat, we will record down. And if there's an appropriate method, then I suppose you can distribute the answers to those afterwards.
If maybe those questions could be compiled into a Google document, then we could answer them there.
Sure. Okay. Thank you very much then. I'll call this to a close and I'll leave the meeting open just for a little while so that if people want to type and chat, that you're welcome to. But thank you very much to everyone for attending.
And just want to say thank you to you and the AMA for organising this at short notice, and for everyone for turning up. I understand that, you know, this is a time of a lot of anxiety for GPs. GPs are really important part of the healthcare system, this I think is reinforcing that. So thanks very much to all of you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, I might sign off, but what I might do is, if you compile those questions, I'll try and type a couple of answers, and we'll work together with the other members of the panel to do that.
Okay, I can put it all in a Google Docs, just like what we did with the pre-webinar questions.
Yep. Yeah, no worries. Okay.
Yep.
Good. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. See you all.
Yeah, if anyone wants to hang around, then we will just give an ad for the Chinese Medical Association of Victoria.
Yep.
If you're not a member, then we invite you all to join so that we can continue to organise and events like this, and to liaise with government and professional bodies to advocate for doctors serving the Chinese community. There's also a resource in the chat. I've placed the links to the Department of Health and Human Services information about coronavirus, as well as the URL for the ACMAV website, where we have put together some information for you to visit as well. In addition, if you want to find out more about ACMAV, apart from visiting our website, you can join our Facebook groups. You can also come to our seminars and our social functions.
The next one, the Yum Cha is cancelled, so the next one will be the bowel cancer dinner. Also, before we wrap up, just want to say thank you to all the committee's members, especially Jason, for pulling this all together last minute, and also for being around this afternoon.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Thank you for doing
that, Jason.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jason.